opportunity to open this meeting and welcome all of us here. We're going to be one another's companions for the whole day today. And I'm sure we will develop skills of tolerance, coping with difficult relations, until the parting time comes. Today, in terms of South African law, we are in a process of legislation. Amongst other things that are required by our law is consultation. Today we'll be consulting with you on the combating of trafficking in persons. Today is public hearings until tomorrow. You know all of you who will be presenting today. I also want to take this opportunity to welcome Mama Mukhoekani and Mama Malgas, who are from a select committee. Oh, Portfolio Committee, Women, Children. I stand corrected. Thank you very much. Being corrected is the healthiest thing. Must never be angry at being corrected. It's an opportunity to grow all the time. So, I have been given 10... I don't know what this thing is supposed to mean. They say 10 open to 10. Ten to ten opening. Commission for Gender Equality, is it here? You've got, you've been told your time. You don't have to take 20 minutes. You can take less. Thank you, sir. Honorable Jigar? I forgot something before even Honorable JJ said. Actually, it is required of me to say, to present to you that the chairperson of this portfolio committee is not around. I am chairing the committee as per the principal decision of the portfolio committee. If there are no objections to that effect, I would want to be allowed to proceed. Are there any objections? I take that silence consents to me chairing. I thank you very much. Commission for Gender Equality. Honorable Jeffrey?
Can you get a copy of the submission? I see that there's only certain members of the parties.
Can you send you a copy to members? Members are sitting in front here, if you don't know them. They are sitting in front. The principals of this meeting. They are sitting there in front.
Honorable Chair, the submissions are in the bundle, and this is the copy of the, it's having a few copies of the presentation.
Are they accessible?
Yes, it's
in the bundle, please.
I didn't draft the bundle. The special drafted by the committee secretary. Please consult with him.
Okay, well, I can't find it in the bundle. I can read them out once.
If you're looking for this is going to be deemed.
And then can we get copies of that, please? Not just me, there's another member of the Justice Commission there, not just me. Another member of the Justice Commission there, and two more there, so we need four, please.
On the screen.
Can you sit down?
What is this one?
Chairperson, I have a problem.
I've got a problem. There's only a few copies of this which are not available for every member. It doesn't appear to be in the bundle. I have a problem also with the attitude of the official from the commission. I'm not sure who he is, whether he's an official. But I then just get told fairly rudely by him, and I think my colleagues around me would agree, oh no, it's on the screen. Now, I mean, this is a Chapter 9 institution, okay? Other bodies, next we have the Catholic Bishops' Conference. They have submitted their, they're a private body. Whether they submit documentation or not is up to them. But I just think this attitude is completely out of order. We need, you know, they're Chapter 9, they're government funded. And now he's having fun with other members here. We need copies of the submission.
Sure.
We need copies of the submission. That's basically a non-negotiable. And to be told, oh no, it's just on the screen, is unacceptable. And in fact, the public should have copies of the submission.
So let me start harmoniously. It's just a question of attitude correction. Can I do that? Because, let me say, there is nothing wrong in what you said. But in terms of attitude, there is something wrong. Honestly, I know the secretary of the committee, must sort it out. There's nothing wrong in terms of the law, but in terms of kind of relationship we require in this environment, it's just an attitude issue. Can I sort it out?
Chairperson, I'm Commissioner Abrams from the Commission for Gender Equality. I would very much like to apologize that submissions are not before the Portfolio Committee. We did hand in our written submission on time. In fact, it's the second submission that we've made. And although we'd like to take responsibility, obviously we're not responsible for it not being in the pack. As far as our PowerPoint presentation is concerned, that normally is also submitted beforehand. Okay. I'm getting the chairperson.
Just a second. Can you come and say yourself?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm Advocate Anirudra, the Parliamentary Office for the Commission on Gender Equality. If the Honourable Member feels that my attitude is wrong, I apologize for that most sincerely. It's not a legal thing. For harmonious relationships, as the Honourable Chair has indicated, I'm very, very sincerely sorry. If you want it in writing, I'll do it to so as well.
Yes, don't complicate it. So sorry,
Thank you.
Can
I ask
how are
you
saying
this?
The next presentation, we don't have these discussions. The committee does have the necessary submission. Can you kick? We start with your 20 minutes. Thank you. You introduce yourselves and then present.
Thank you, Chairperson. Like I said, I'm Commissioner Abrams. I'm Commissioner for Gender Equality based in the Western Cape. With me is our Parliamentary Officer, Advocate Anirudra. I would just like to preface this by saying, for those of you who are not aware, that this year is 500 years since the first slave raid in the Western Cape, that by Francisco de Almeida in 1510. It also marks the date of the very first war in South Africa, namely when the Khoisan stood up in defense of their children and that day killed 150 Portuguese sailors. So my point is that we have had human trafficking in this country for 500 years. I am overjoyed both personally and professionally that Parliament is taking steps to outlaw this vicious human crime, and we make our submission in the hope that we will finally, 500 years later, see an end to this terrible scourge. Thank you, Chairperson, and I hand over to Advocate Anirudra for the presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable members of this Portfolio Committee, thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation before you. I will now proceed. Firstly, our constitutional mandate. We have two mandates. One flows out of the Constitution in terms of Section 187, and it reads as follows. The Commission on Gender Equality must promote respect for gender equality and the protection, development, and attainment of gender equality. This submission is made in terms of our legal mandate, which flows out of the Commission on Gender Equality Act. That's Section 11. And in terms of that act, CGE, or the Commission on Gender Equality, shall evaluate any law proposed for Parliament which is likely to affect gender equality or the status of women, and we are obliged to make recommendations to Parliament in this context. Our first comment, and this relates to the definition of bear with me 1 minute. To the definition of debt bondage. Currently, what the CG notes is that the test for any pledge to be recognized as debt bondage is limited to purely economic factors. And this, to us, offers very limited protection to victims of trafficking. Therefore, the CGE recommends an extension to that definition of debt bondage to include the term contra bonus mores, or actually the maxim, contra bonus mores. And this then would cover or embrace the range of bad practices that accompany trafficking. Our next comment relates to the definition of exploitation. What the Commission notes is that deprivation of access to support services and basic rights has not been included in the definition of exploitation. And we feel that this is necessary because the membership of a union, access to UIF benefits, access to healthcare and social services are basic rights. And one will find that victims of trafficking are in a deprived state or kept in a deprived status. And this keeps them below the radar. And if this deprivation is allowed to continue, it will compromise the detection and the combating and prevention of trafficking. Therefore, the CGE recommends that deprivation be included in the definition of exploitation. The next comment relates to an increased penalty for conviction of the offense of debt bondage. In our earlier submission, we recommended that the penalty be increased from 10 years to a higher term, because for the penalty of trafficking, the minimum sentence applies. We are pleased to note that this has been recognized by the drafters, and the term of 15 years is therefore supported in this bill. The revision of Section 6 relating to the destruction, confiscation, concealment, and tampering of travel documents that belong to a victim of trafficking, which includes the increased penalty from 5 years to 10 years, is also supported by the Commission. And this was raised in the previous submission that we made. Therefore, we are supportive of this change in the existing bill, or the current bill. Furthermore, in its previous submission, the CGE raised a concern with the lenient penalty of 5 years for the conviction of the use of the services of a trafficked person. Now, the CGE feels that the use of the services of a trafficked person constitutes the demand side of trafficking, and a reduced term or a small term creates numerous problems to the extent that one will opt to plea bargain and go for a softer option. Therefore, we note that the increase of the penalty in the current bill is extended, and the CGE supports this. Our further comment relates to Section 10, Subsection 6, where the National Director of Public Prosecutions will be required to provide written authorizations for prosecutions in terms of this Act. Now, this approach is excellent, as the CGE believes that if the authority lies with high-ranking officials, a watertight case will normally be prepared, and this will result in improved convictions. So such a provision might seem cumbersome, but it is supported by the CGE. Also, the inclusion of Section 11, which requires a court to consider certain factors when a court hears this matter or it wants to make a decision, is also supported. But the CGE believes that the following factors must also be considered. Firstly, the relationship between the victim and the perpetrator. Secondly, whether a compensation order will be made. And thirdly, the rising of any life-threatening infections as the result of the trafficking. Now, Section 11 tries to bring about uniformity when sentences or when judgments are being made. So therefore, these three criteria which we raise would assist, because they are pertinent issues that should be considered. Also, we find that the reporting referral of child victims in terms of Section 12 is supported in the current form. Although the referral of adult victims in terms of 13 is supported, we have two problems herein. Firstly, in terms of subsection 7, where a certificate is issued confirming that the victim is a victim of trafficking, one finds that if an official makes a decision that's not lawful, reasonable, or procedurally fair, in other words, the victim is denied the certificate, he has no opportunity to challenge that decision. And this decision is, in terms of law, administrative action. So in order to review such a decision, in terms of the act, the way it's, in terms of the bill, the way it's drafted, this victim has to now take that decision on review to the High Court. And this is an untenable situation. It will result in secondary victimization. Therefore, the CGE believes that this needs serious attention, and it recommends that an internal or external review mechanism be built into the bill to cure this defect. Also, the CGE is concerned that certain professionals, for example, a doctor or a social worker, cannot report any suspicion in respect of a person being trafficked that comes to their attention. Now this is also problematic, because a victim of trafficking is in a vulnerable situation, and there might be undue influence on them to have the matter reported. So we feel that that section should also be reviewed, and any suspicion, whether it's an adult or a child, should be reportable by any professional. Because if a doctor reports his suspicions of a person being a victim of trafficking, there's a likelihood that he or she could be charged criminally. And this is not acceptable. Permanent residence, in terms of Section 19 in the bill, the CGE does not support the fact that the 5-year period for permanent residence will commence on the date that the temporary residence permit was issued to a victim of trafficking. Now, the problem here is that a victim of trafficking could be in bondage or debt bondage for a period of 20 years. So, such a clause could prejudice that victim when he or she applies for permanent residence. So, the CGE believes that the existing provision will definitely prejudice victims, and recommends that the period for consideration of permanent residence to be calculated from the time that the victim enters the Republic as a victim of trafficking. That would be more in keeping with the interests of justice. In respect of minimum standards in terms of Section 21, subsection 3, as proposed in the bill, the CG believes that Section 21, subsection 3, does not meet the constitutional standards which is contemplated in Section 28 of the Constitution. In this regard, the CG recommends that children in the care of an adult victim must also be assessed in respect of the need for care, protection, and their developmental needs. And such findings should be reportable to the Department of Social Development within 24 hours for further intervention in terms of the Child Care Act or other law. In respect of compensation, as proposed in Section 27 of the bill herein, although the CGs in support of the section. However, we have reservations in respect of the monetary jurisdictions which is retained in keeping with the court's adherence to the matter. In this respect, we find that the district court is limited to jurisdiction 100,000 rands, the regional court 300,000 rands, and the high court has unlimited jurisdiction. Now, the problem that may arise is that where a district court hears a matter, and at the end, when compensation is being awarded, and there has been a finding during the course of the hearing that the victim is entitled to not 100,000 but 500,000 rands, maybe due to HIV infection arising out of being trafficked, then this is problematic because that district court is limited to a jurisdiction of 100,000 rands. So it creates a problem. Therefore, the CGE recommends that in such a situation, either jurisdiction in terms of monetary amounts be waived, or the district court should not be allowed to hear a matter relating to trafficking. The establishment of the intersectorial committee, or the IC, the CG supports this provision and takes note that the revised section allows now for the Human Rights Commission, the CG, to be invited at the discretion of the IC, or the intersectorial committee. Now, the CG is still not satisfied with the change. It must be borne in mind that this falls short of the recommendations made by the CGE, and full membership of the CGE as well as the Human Rights Commission is still proposed. Secondly, the Commission notes that the Ministry for Women, Children and People with Disabilities has been ignored and recommends its inclusion as well, because you find that victims of trafficking generally are women, or predominantly women and children, and it is quite incomprehensible as to why this omission is evident in this bill. Also, why the CGE feels that it should have a place, as well as the Ministry for Women, Children and People with Disabilities, is that the Intersectorial Committee has a wide-ranging set of responsibilities. It will set out the national policy framework. It will monitor compliance with this Act. It will also monitor to what extent convictions and acquittals take place in respect of human trafficking offences. Also, it will monitor who the transnational or the domestic perpetrators are. And these aspects fall squarely within the mandate of the CGE. And therefore, the CG is quite concerned as to why this omission takes place and recommends full membership for the Human Rights Commission and the CGE on the Intersectorial Committee. In conclusion, the CGE welcomes this bill, and we are encouraged by the progressive nature of the provisions herein. It's quite an exemplary piece of legislative drafting. There's no doubt about that. We also note that the bill takes cognizance of the transnational nature of trafficking, and this is commendable on the part of the legislative unit of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. The CG looks forward to the gaps that exist being addressed, because these may serve to compromise the excellent work done thus far by this wonderful committee and the legislative unit of the drafting unit of the Department of Constitutional Development. We thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Quite efficient in terms of presentation. But for our committee members, Honourable Swartz, Honourable Jeffrey, Honourable Ambrosini, those are the three that I have. And my advice is that you must write all your questions and respond in summary and block.
Thank you, Chair. I feel somewhat, the one member referred to 500 years ago, and I think that is quite apt, and I think that we as MPs almost feel like William Wilberforce 200 years ago that fought slavery globally. But isn't it disgraceful that we sit with the levels of slavery again today? And I think what I'd like to get an indication is, Do we have, has the Commission done any investigation into the extent of trafficking in South Africa? And that is an issue that we all need to be aware of. What is the extent? I do appreciate the specific recommendations that have been made, and I've just received your document now, and I accept your apology. Thank you for that. But a recent report by the Human Science Research Council, and I don't know if you contributed to their research, indicated that knowledge of trafficking in South Africa still suffers from a serious lack of hard data. South Africa is not collecting even basic national level data which will facilitate insight into the national situation. And my research seems to indicate that nobody seems to know the extent of what's going on in South Africa. And whilst we were grateful that there wasn't a spike during the World Cup, but the fact remains that trafficking continues to be widespread in South Africa. And I would just like to get an indication generally from the Commission whether you've done any research into this area, which is of huge concern to all of us. But thank you for your comments, and thank you for your inputs on the first draft of the bill as well. Thank you.
A few things. Look, obviously, as far as the process, this bill has been tabled. Earlier versions of the bill and earlier submissions you made were not made to us. So when you talk about you welcome the fact that your earlier submissions were responded to, don't assume we know what you're talking about, because we didn't see those submissions. They were not to us. You should know the parliamentary process. So it would be a thing of saying, okay, we objected to this in an earlier draft. The department changed it. Then, as far as your submissions, wanting to include the pledge under bondage of debt bondage as a pledge that is contra bonos mores. The difficulty is, I mean, whilst the term contra bonos mores may be legally understood, we are trying to produce, as I'm sure you'd appreciate, legislation that is understandable. Most people don't understand Latin, whether they be members of the public or even more recently, people in the legal system. So I think you need to flesh, I hear what you're saying, I think you need to flesh that out a bit more. Then I note with regard to the referral in clause 13, and you want the review mechanism to be given to yourselves or the Human Rights Commission. I mean, it's a little bit beyond your powers as to what you've had before. I mean, in terms of other administrative, I hear your point about having to go to court, but I think the thing would probably be more aptly solved by a review to the minister, for example. I mean, that happens in terms of decisions relating to social grants. And remember that this decision is not just taken by officials, but it can also be taken by accredited NGOs. The Section 19 permanent residence, I mean, the difficulty there is that it's in terms of the Immigration Act. That's what applies to everybody else. So wanting a special dispensation for people who were trafficked has some difficulties from that point of view. The issue of CGE being on the interministerial or intersectoral committee, again, have you thought that through properly in terms of those are government departments? CGE's role and the Human Rights Commission role is monitoring. Can you monitor when you're actually part of a governmental committee? I mean, I think we take the point of the Ministry or Department of Women and Children, and presumably the omission was because the bill was drafted before that department or ministry were in existence. But I don't know if it's such a good idea for either of the Chapter 9 commissions to be represented on effectively a government committee when they're meant to be playing a monitoring role. And it's a question of, have you thought that through?
Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to clarify that I'm going to ask this question because I do not have the answer. It's not a way of making a statement. And I would like Mr. Chairman to table a concern that perhaps can be answered by this presenter and perhaps by the other presenters today who are here today and can hear my question without my need of repeating the question, which will save time to everyone. A sort of a standing question. And that's my personal concern. Again, I might be wrong, but I'd like to voice it. In general speaking, I have no problems with what is in this bill and what is in the convention. We are going to make it a better bill. I think that the questions colleagues are answering will go in the process, and we are in the process of making a better bill. So I have no problem with what it is that we are doing. But I come from the burning experience of a similar process where we subscribed to an equally meritorious convention, perhaps the best convention ever written, the Refugee Protection Convention and the 1951 Protocol. We adopted legislation for implementing it. Again, beautiful legislation, wonderful process, and the entire system collapsed because the convention and implementing legislation was utilized by people who did not qualify. And there, as it is in this case, there is an assessment of circumstances. People come with a set of circumstances which enable them to qualify for benefits. And I ask for political asylum. I'm entitled to these benefits. And the system cannot assess those circumstances. So the entire system of refugee control is stopped to a grounding halt, and we've got Section 41B permits more than there are immigration permits. Now, my concern here is that we are setting in place another system which will give benefits on the basis of circumstances which I don't see as having the administrative capacity of determining, especially when they are across international lines and circumstances which took place in Bangkok, in Hong Kong, where the representations were made in a different language. So we are in a situation where either we believe the applicant onto the applicant an incredible burden of proving circumstances beyond he or she saying so. We don't know how many people we have now who are affected by this problem. It could be 10, it could be 100, it could be 10,000. Nobody really knows. But I do suspect, and this is my question, that once we pass this bill, whatever number we have now will be multiplied by a very large factor, and many of them are people who are going to abuse the system to take the benefits, both domestic people and both international people, not only from Africa but from the East in large quantities. Am I wrong? Is this a concern that I should not have? And this is what troubles me, and I put it before the presenters and the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, what I would like to ask is from the CGE when it comes to Section 11. The CGE made certain proposals where they speak about the relationship between the victim and the perpetrator, and then they go to number 3. But when you look at Section 11, it says that the court that imposes the sentence must consider, but is not limited to. It's not limited to A to H. So I'd like to know from the CGE, why do they want these 3 included in A to H? And then the other thing is, we come from the other committee. We're not on the Justice Committee. I would like to know what do this Latin term means. Where is it? So that if there is a follow-up, then I can ask a follow-up question. Yes, it's about more or something. Yes. What does it mean?
Uh,
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chair. Contrabonus mores means contrary to good morals. So anything that is, yes.
It really doesn't, and that's why the Latin expression is used. It doesn't mean that. There is no English word with which the word mores can be translated other than the accepted pool of social values or the fundamental social convention.
Sorry.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. As the resident Latinist in this committee, I'm just pointing to the fact that the Latin word is used because there is no English word capable of translating it.
Can I explain?
Honorable Chair, yes. Very, very quickly, you have moral standards norms, right? Moral standard norms are really unwritten rules that a society or a community will observe. And mores falls into one of this category. Mores means the rules of a particular community or society that will be observed, right? Or it finds that it needs to uphold for the good of that community or society. So that is the translation, and I've just given it to you. Standards are also written or unwritten rules which a society will ascribe or try to live up to. And norms are unwritten rules which exist over time period which a society will observe.
Chairperson, I will answer three questions and then I will hand over to Advocate Anirudra to answer the rest. Firstly, with reference to research, the HSRC is absolutely correct. We don't have proper research into the extent of trafficking. And it's not a new situation. I mean, we've been working with gender-based violence for 15 years, and it's equally one of these almost unresearchable areas. Similarly, HIV/AIDS, we have indicators as the rate of maternal infections, but, you know, we continually having to be in this position where on gender issues we have to make public policy without proper research information, simply because of the complexities of the research. The CG is a founding member of the Human Trafficking Forum, which is a civil society Chapter 9 body, and some of the civil society members are here today, so I'm sure that they will give you more information. But through that interaction, we're collecting quite a bit of qualitative data. What we can tell you with certainty, we can't tell you numbers. We can tell you that the most of the trafficking that happens is actually internal trafficking. It is from impoverished rural areas in South Africa to the urban areas. It's been that way ever since apartheid, and what happens with the post-94 external trafficking is it plugs into those internal trafficking routes, and that's why the Human Trafficking Forum spends a lot of time working on both internal and external. You have to approach both problems simultaneously. Most of the trafficking is actually not for sexual purposes, it's for domestic work. And so, you know, there's a raft of other measures and legislations that have to be enforced to make this particular act work. So the qualitative data we can assist you with. We normally when we make a submission, we recommend that an adequate, you know, it is law that every act must be properly budgeted for. We're assuming that this committee knows that, and that is why we have not specifically made that call. But certainly we would recommend setting aside a specific budget for research. With respect to the intersectoral committee, Honourable Member, the Constitution requires of us, like Alice in Wonderland, that we do two impossible things before breakfast, and that is what the CG does. Our job is not just to monitor, we're also required to research and educate on matters of gender equality. And we often, because research is a small, gender research is a small field, and the pool of expertise is very small. We often find ourselves in positions where the people that we are educating and who we are providing research for are government people. They are part of the executive. So we sit on a number of committees where that is exactly what we do. We monitor in the mornings and we educate in the afternoons. This will be nothing new to us. Yes. Lastly, honourable members, is there not a risk that this law will be utilised by people who do not qualify for benefits? I'm going to be very tactful about this and say that our immigration policy is not the tightest in the world, and that unlike the European Union, the illegal immigrants is not something that appears to bother us terribly here in South Africa. Yeah, that was my tactful stint for the day. So my point is that you know, as far as the CG is concerned, we would rather take the risk that some people will benefit who should not benefit, in the hope that at least we catch all those who require this law. If that's the price we're going to have to pay, in our opinion, it's a small price. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to Edward.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and my learned colleague. Thank you, Honourable Member, for those questions, and I think the questions are very welcome because it helps us also to revisit our thoughts and processes. The first question I'd like to look at is the pledge and the use of the term contra bonus moris. Now, what we are thinking about here is that limiting the pledge just to economic considerations is rather limited because it doesn't cover scenarios like, for example, the trafficker might enter into a contract with the trafficked person where the contract states that you shall work for me for 20 years and at the end of the 20 years you shall receive payment for your services. Now that is contrary to good morals, and we don't know whether those contracts exist, and it's highly likely that such contracts do exist. So that is the reason why we indicated that we have such a clause there, because essentially it's to embrace scenarios that are a reality which face victims of trafficking. Maybe the term contra bonus mores might be difficult for some people to understand, but it's a very acceptable and it's a quite well-used term. And even if you consider the term itself contra means against, bonus, the people, the community, and mores, as I just explained, unwritten rules, which a society has come to observe as a standard that must be adhered to, and which is enforceable by a community or a population. That's the difference about a set of mores. They're enforceable, okay, as opposed to a standard or a norm. Norms may not be enforceable, but mores are enforceable. Okay. So I hope that brings about more clarity. In respect of Clause 13, I agree with the Honourable Member who says that the review mechanism becomes problematic if you take it out of the organisation that's making the initial decision, and it's true that the appeal decision should lie within the organization itself because it must cure its own defects, and I agree. And the CG believes that at first light, the review mechanism should be located within the Department of Social Development. But in the event that where the drafters feel that maybe it's necessary for the review mechanism to be outside or beyond the Department of Social Development, then the recommendation is that a review mechanism could be spread outwards. And this exists in South African law. We have review mechanisms such as the Judicial Inspector to Prisons, where you have objective, very quick, very nice decisions of review being performed over DCS by the Judicial Inspectorate. So to bring in a an environment of objectivity and swift action. That is why we said, or we recommended, that the CGE and Human Rights Commission be considered. It will also give them an opportunity to monitor the level of poor decisions being made by the Departments of Social Development. So thank you for those questions. In respect of the other one, I come to section 19, where the Honourable Member indicates that if a special dispensation is being offered to victims of trafficking, then this is counter to section 10 of the Immigration Act. The CG concede that that is true, but one needs to look at the situation very, very realistically. A victim of trafficking is a vulnerable person, and the reality is that these victims could be in debt bondage for protracted periods. They could be violated in numerous ways. So, in keeping with our constitutional standards, we must always act in a manner that's reasonable and justifiable in a democracy, and our actions must show that this is being done. So, what is wrong if this act allows for a person that's being held in an untenable situation for 10 years to be given the privilege of being considered for permanent residence? Because the prejudice is not severe, because the victim has been in
Guarani criminals.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Because the person has been in subjugation for 20 years. So it means that he has been, or she has been in this country for 20 years. And then he or she has fulfilled a period of 5 years. So it's just a technicality. I think that is being overlooked. And that is why we suggest, from the time that the person has entered the country, that is the trigger to calculate the time period. In respect of the intersectorial committee, the CGE believes that this is a monitoring and compliance mechanism built into the bill. And it would be healthy for the CGE to interact at this level, because not only does intersectorial committee formulate and look at policy relating to the treatment and combating victims of trafficking, but they also cross-pollinate ideas. And this is the only reason why the CGE felt that, since it has a large focus, and as the Honourable Member indicated, that what has the CGE done in respect of delving and looking into issues of trafficking, this would be an opportunity to do just that. Section 11, Honourable Member Malkas brings about a pertinent question. We find that the three issues that we speak about might be overlooked by certain courts, and if it's steeped in statute, then it will definitely be considered by all courts who make decisions. So it will be a uniform, let's say, consideration that's being applied across the country to all victims. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Pass all the members, because the time totally given to that presenter is over. Can we proceed to the next, why is this list? Catholic bishops. I hope you all have presentations, all members. Thank you.
We thank the TG for being here as well.
The second time I also counted. I'm trying to type in mine in your back. Yeah.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, Dumelang, Ani Bonani, good morning to you all. My name is Kevin Dowling. I'm the Bishop, the Catholic Bishop of Rustenburg, and I'm the Liaison Bishop to the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference Parliamentary Liaison Committee, which sits here in Cape Town and does its work here. My colleagues on my left, Father Peter John Pearson, the Director of the Parliamentary Office, and Samantha Richmond, one of our researchers. It's an honor to be with you today. Going straight into the introduction, trafficking in persons has always been of considerable concern to our church, and consequently, the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference warmly welcomes this second opportunity to comment on what is unquestionably an extremely important and very necessary piece of legislation. The latest version of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Bill, which has been redrafted approximately 1 year after the initial draft, not only provides a robust legal framework within which persons accused of human trafficking can be prosecuted, but it also provides a holistic approach to the prevention of trafficking. So we would also like to take this opportunity to commend the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for the speed with which the second version of this bill has been redrafted and brought before Parliament. It demonstrates to the public and civil society a necessary urgency and commitment on the part of the government to deal with this deeply disturbing practice that has plagued our society. While the latest version of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking Persons Bill can be applauded on numerous grounds, there nevertheless remain for us a few areas of concern which are highlighted below now. Firstly, regarding aims. We welcome the strong alignment between the aims of the bill and the United Nations Protocol to prevent, suppress, and punish trafficking in persons. However, the bill does not make specific reference to the issue of demand, as it is outlined in Article 9, Clause 4 and 5 of the Protocol, which reads as follows, quote, "States parties shall take or strengthen measures, including through bilateral or multilateral cooperation, to alleviate the factors that make persons, especially women and children, vulnerable to trafficking, such as poverty, underdevelopment, and lack of equal opportunity. States parties shall adopt or strengthen legislative or other measures, such as educational, social, or cultural measures, including through bilateral and multilateral cooperation, to discourage the demand that fosters all forms of exploitation of persons, especially women and children, that leads to trafficking." End of quote. Now, it is a well-known fact that the supply of trafficked persons is highly dependent on the demand for trafficked persons. Thus, while we welcome Clause 2.1d in Chapter 2, which makes specific reference to this issue of demand, we feel that it is an important issue that also needs to be reflected within the broader aims of the bill, in addition to its incorporation within prevention strategies. Going on to the preamble of the bill makes a necessary and appropriate reference to the Bill of Rights in the following manner, quote, "And since the Bill of Rights in the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996 enshrines the right to human dignity, the right to freedom and security of the person, which includes the right not to be deprived of freedom arbitrarily or without just cause, the right not to be subjected to slavery, servitude, or forced labor, and the right of children to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse, or degradation." Now, while reference is made to the right to human dignity, the right to freedom and security, the right not to be subjected to slavery, servitude, or forced labor, and the right of children to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse, or degradation, No reference is made to one of the fundamental rights enshrined in our Constitution, that is, the right of equality, or the right to equality. Women and children are the most vulnerable to becoming victims of trafficking simply because of their gender and age. By specifically highlighting the right to equality, the proposed bill would go some way to acknowledging and dealing with the inherent discrimination that women and children are faced with as the preferred victims of trafficking. Chapter 1, Definitions and Objects of the Act. We welcome the definition of trafficking as it is currently conceptualized in the proposed bill. Its broad conceptual base will ensure the protection of any person involved in the trafficking of another person. Prosecution of any person involved in the trafficking of another person. Apologies. We find the definition of abuse of vulnerability slightly problematic. The abuse of vulnerability can be more broadly understood as the abuse of a situation of vulnerability. By making specific reference to physical or psychological abuse, the bill significantly narrows the conditions under which a victim's vulnerable condition can be considered to have been abused. The words physical or psychological should be removed from the definition so as to ensure that trafficked victims who have not necessarily been physically or psychologically abused, but whose vulnerable situation has nonetheless been abused, are afforded the opportunity to seek justice. Going to Chapter 2, Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons. We welcome the establishment of an intersectoral committee which will be tasked with promoting public awareness on the issue of human trafficking. By placing emphasis on information and education, the government confirms its proactive commitment to preventing and combating trafficking in persons. We also welcome Clause 3.2 of this chapter, which stipulates that information be made available in accessible languages and be disseminated in rural areas. It is absolutely vital that those most vulnerable to trafficking be targeted by such programs. Clause 3.1c of this chapter tasks the intersectoral committee with the establishment and implementation of public awareness campaigns and other measures that will, quote, discourage the demand for and the supply of victims of trafficking that fosters the exploitation of those victims, especially women and children, end of quote. Unlike Clause 3.1a and b, however, the bill remains extremely vague on how the intersectoral committee will go about achieving this. It is important to provide the Intersectoral Committee with as much guidance as possible so as to ensure that such public awareness campaigns are embarked upon quickly and efficiently. Chapter 3, Concerning Offences, Penalties and Extraterritorial Jurisdiction. The provisions and penalties set out in Clauses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 and 9 are welcomed, especially those pertaining to internet service providers. These penalties will, however, need to be strictly enforced in order for them to constitute a reasonable deterrent. Moreover, those prosecuted and convicted of a trafficking in persons offense, but whose role in the trafficking process was relatively insignificant, should be more eligible to receive a fine rather than imprisonment. Chapter 4, Identification and Protection of Victims of Trafficking. Due to their different needs, the separate reporting and referral guidelines for child and adult victims of trafficking in Clauses 12 and 13 are generally welcome. We also welcome the right of foreign victims of trafficking to access public health care services, as in Clause 15, and the prohibition of criminal prosecutions against victims of trafficking, Clause 16. Clause 12, however, does not take into consideration instances in which members of the local police service are involved in the trafficking process. There is evidence of this currently occurring in relation to young girls and women being trafficked from rural to urban areas as domestic workers. Therefore, some provision needs to be made within the bill in order to account for instances such as these. Furthermore, Clause 13.1b, which stipulates that a social worker, social service professional, medical practitioner, nurse, traditional health practitioner, traditional healer or traditional leader may only report a matter to a police official as provided for in paragraph A if the victim has given his or her written consent in the prescribed manner. That is somewhat problematic. Not only is it rather curious why immigration officers and labor inspectors have been exempted from obtaining such consent, but such a requirement would significantly reduce the reporting of trafficking incidents. Victims of trafficking have in most cases suffered severe emotional and physical trauma, and as such are usually frightened, despondent, and untrusting of everyone around them. Obtaining written consent would require some level of trust between the trafficked victim and the person reporting the incidents of trafficking, which may not only take some time to establish, but because of the lived experience of the trafficked victim, be difficult to obtain. While we understand the need to respect an individual's agency, serious consideration needs to be given to the grave nature of trafficking before such a restriction is enforced. Clause 13.7 stipulates that, quote, if, after an assessment referred to in subsection 5b, it is found that the person concerned is a victim of trafficking, a certificate as prescribed must be issued to him or her, certifying him or her to be a victim of trafficking. We understand the need for some form of certification, especially for victims of trafficking who need to access services. But we feel that branding a trafficked person in such a manner would further dehumanize him or her. More sensitive consideration, therefore, needs to be given to how best to afford trafficked victims the opportunity to access services without this form of branding. Chapter 5, the status of foreign victims of trafficking. We welcome clauses 17, 18, and 19, which allow foreign victims of trafficking a recovery and reflection period not exceeding 90 days, and entitles them to apply for temporary or permanent residence in South Africa, respectively. Clause 17.2 stipulates that, quote, if a foreigner referred to in subsection 1 after a period of 30 days since he or she has been granted a recovery and reflection period is unwilling to cooperate with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities in the investigation of and the prosecution of a trafficker, an investigation into his or her circumstances must be conducted by the Director General, Social Development, in order to determine whether it is safe to return him or her to his or her country of origin or the country from where he or she has been trafficked. It is somewhat concerning that trafficked person victims who choose not to cooperate with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities in the investigation of and prosecution of a trafficker are subject to repatriation. It is not uncommon for trafficked victims who have suffered severe trauma to not cooperate with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities precisely because of their traumatic experience. Moreover, repatriation is not always an option, especially when victims of trafficking are from countries in crisis as a result of civil wars, genocide, natural disasters, or famine. should victims of trafficking not want to cooperate with law enforcement and prosecuting authorities, provision must be made for them to be assisted to apply for asylum or refugee status under the applicable legislation once their recovery and reflection period has ended. And Chapter 6, Services to Adult Victims of Trafficking. The minimum norms and standards and the intersectoral approach outlined in this chapter are encouraging. It is our hope that the facilities and services will be established with great urgency once the bill has been enacted. We particularly welcome the provision in Clause 22B for financial assistance to be made available to accredited organizations. And so our conclusion. While a large portion of the guidelines outlined in the bill are yet to be gazetted, it is undeniable that the government seeks to find a holistic approach to address the issue of trafficking in persons. The Catholic Church commends the South African Law Reform Commission and the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for its work in drafting this important bill. Trafficking in persons is a serious violation of human dignity, and we take this opportunity to pledge our ongoing support for government's efforts to tackle this growing scourge. We thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thanks for sticking to your time, Catholics. Question time, Honourable Members. Honourable Schwartz. Dapane. Go on. Honourable Members, and your standing question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Bishop Darlin, for your input and your comprehensive submission. One of the issues we're trying to grapple with is the extent of the problem, and I think all people that will be making submissions will be asked that question as to what is their knowledge as to the extent of the problem, because there's no data in South Africa. So could you give us an indication of the Catholic Church's involvement with shelters possibly, or just your anecdotal evidence as to the extent of the problem in South Africa? Do you keep any stats as to victims that you might counsel or anything? I know there is a confidentiality there, but can you give us an idea as to the extent of the problem that you're faced with in South Africa? There is also a very significant statement that you make relating to Clause 12 that came out very prominently in the Human Science Research Council, and that is the extent of collusion between law enforcement officers, SA Police, Department of Home Affairs, well, you don't mention Home Affairs, but you mentioned police service in particular, and possibly you could just allude to that slightly more. That confirms what is said in the Human Science Research Council, where there is the report found repeated allegations of collusion between the SAPS and the Department of Home Affairs and traffickers. And this is obviously an issue of great concern for us as parliamentarians, and that was a very useful suggestion there to add police into that section as well. So if you could just assist us in that regard. Thank you very much, Bishop.
Honourable Chair, what I want to point out from the Bishop is regarding the equality he is concerned about. Don't you feel, the Bishop, that there are certain sections that refer specifically to women and children in this bill? For example, Section 22 and Section 313 and other sections that refer specifically to women and children. Again, in Section 313, you feel that the bill is a little bit vague regarding that section. Do you have any suggestions you may put forward that you feel they might be added to the bill? And again, there is a question of Section 34, Section 1B, the written consent from the victim, which you feel it will make it a little bit difficult for the whistleblowers to approach the official concern. Don't you feel that clause or that section is for the protection of the whistleblower when the victim now denies that he or she was a victim. And finally, Section 17, Subsection 2, Section 17, Subsection 2. I think I got this one wrong. Sorry, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Bishop. Just a few questions, Bishop. One, regarding your definitions and objects of the Act, that you want the you find the abuse of vulnerability slightly problematic. I must say I disagree with you on that. I think that it is essential that, we have that there. And specifically, I think it's essential that the physical or psychological abuse remains there. Because what we find is the majority of these people that come in, those that aren't under debt bondage, that those that have been brought in specifically for the sex trade, have gone through great deals of abuse with regards to their person, with regards to their psyche. These are children who suffer abuse that no child should ever have to suffer. They are women and young men. It goes, you know, a very broad spectrum. And by the time we actually find them, they've been made to do things that no human being should ever be made to do. And I would almost go so far as to say that being a Catholic myself, I was very impressed to see that my congregation specifically told children during the World Cup what they must look out for in shopping centres. And I thought it was very brave of my particular parish priest to take that bold step and make an uncomfortable statement during a Sunday parish. And I was very proud that he'd done that. So I think it's important that these things stay there. And perhaps instead of removing them, perhaps elaborate even further on what it could be. And then just on the prevention of combating of trafficking of humans, I put a question mark here. Oh, yes, it's the Intersectoral Committee. Could you elaborate a little bit more as to what you would like this Intersectoral Committee to do? Because you say that you wanted to, remains extremely vague on how the Intersectoral Committee will go about achieving this. What is your view for this Intersectoral Committee to achieve?
I'm partially covered by the, of course, fully covered by the Honorable Schwartz, but just to build on what is said, the presentation from the Catholic Bishop was stressed on several occasions what is common and what is what is uncommon, what happens in many cases, etc. So if we could have, not as an oral reply, but if we could have the information and the cases on which the statements are based, obviously depersonalized or de-identified. We don't need to have names and things, but since the product of what seems to be an extensive research and database has been offered, it would be very instructive for all of us to acquire that information, to have a sense of the magnitude and the typology of what it is that we are talking about. Thank you.
Although you distorted the meaning of full, so you are fully covered and you proceeded.
Chair, I must say that it's a pity that the bill was drafted before the new ministry was in place. Perhaps one could have had, you know, better understanding and a better contribution to the bill. But nevertheless, I think I want to support the Bishop. First, thanks for the presentation, Bishop. When he talks about the issue of the certificate on chapter 4, clause 13, I think it's line 50, I would also not support the issue of issuing a certificate, because it sort of now brands this particular person. So I would also support that
we find another better way of addressing that. And also, I take it that Bishop, you have been, as a church, at some stage, had the opportunity of giving services to trafficked persons. So one would just want to understand what are the challenges that you face when you render services to these victims. And also, do you think, in your view, whether the bill makes adequate provision for rendering the necessary services to the victims? Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop.
For the questions, we are going to share the responses among the team here. So I'll hand over first to Father Peter John.
Thank you. I think to respond to the question about the abuse of vulnerability and the... I think you're absolutely right. We probably phrased it a little clumsily. It's not the deletion so much as the extension. I think any formulation that narrows when the definition, when there are clearly other factors, it's to include those factors that we were pointing to it. And so I would say, yeah, what we're really looking for is a widening so that other critical aspects that could be missed or could provide good reason in law to excuse something are not overlooked, and those don't become loopholes through which this bad practice can continue. So we would agree with that and want it. And I think part of our commitment that you referred to was that over that period there was a great deal of work published by the church and other churches and faith communities as well, geared towards educating people and sensitizing people to the dangers. The area around SAPS and home affairs, and we have only anecdotal evidence, but in fairly extensive pastoral work that we do around this issue, it's the victims come up time and again and say the police, the officials, and often can't clarify beyond that in terms of who and what rank and so forth. But we thought it wise to flag the issue, since it crops up so often anecdotally, that there must be some basis for concern and for further investigation and for further dialogue with the appropriate authorities, which is something that we've also begun to institute in those places where such instances have been reported. We have taken it up at district level and so forth and provincial level. So it's not that we are simply throwing it out here. We are doing some backup work with it. I think with regard to the intersectorial committee and what we would like to see, the vagueness is not necessarily a criticism. It's what we would hope is an invitation to further dialogue, to dialogue with various stakeholders who have developed in civil society expertise in the kinds of areas which could strengthen the guidelines and contextualize them. So we would hope that as a first step, that kind of ongoing dialogue would take place with the appropriate authorities. That's what we are asking for, and I think in terms of that, specifics will be raised. What we would want to say is that the vast pastoral expertise that we have on the ground and that we have developed and that we can make known, the Catholic Bishops' Conference have a special unit within its structure that deals entirely and only with trafficking in persons. So it's the level of seriousness with which we take this scourge, and unfortunately the director of that is on leave at the moment, and so she couldn't be with us in our team. But I think there is an expertise, and I think we would want to be part of developing those guidelines.
I would just like to echo Father Peter John and say the issue of demand was not necessarily a criticism. And I feel, you know, the issue about the extent of the problem falls in with the issue of demand, because I think it can only be addressed once we know what exactly, how, what the problem looks like. So I think research can certainly help in finding out solutions and how we can address that issue. On the issue of equality, I do think that women and children's needs have been strongly highlighted throughout the bill. The comment on that particular point was simply to highlight that specific, highlight equality in the beginning and make it strongly, you know, put versus, yes, it's more just about putting the word in the beginning, more so than actually being incorporated in the bill, which I think it has. The issue of the written consent is a very tricky issue, and I think what we aim to do was just bring up the difficulties with, on the one hand, you know, protecting the whistleblower, as you said, and on the other hand, just the nature of the problem, and affording, you know, working with that kind of dynamic. So I don't necessarily think there's a straight, clear-cut answer, but I think it's something that does need to be thought about very strongly, because it is a very tricky issue. Thank you.
I'm looking at the time. That will be the last question. Or are you still responding, Bishop?
I was just going to take up just the underlying response to your question, Honourable Member, because obviously our concern comes from our involvement with people and picking up what's happening on the ground, and an overall pastoral holistic response which we've highlighted and which we are very pleased to see in the bill. It's dealing with the person in their whole situation, and we'd like to very much commend that. What we would like, certainly in terms of the challenges you outlined here, is to simply say that it's incumbent upon the whole civil society sector, of which the church is one part, to absolutely collaborate and work with in a very upfront and committed way with the legislation as it is enforced and with the provisions here. The government and its arms, its various arms, cannot do everything, and therefore it's absolutely important that the church sector engages with the various stakeholders or the various relevant departments in the implementation of this bill and in looking at some of the practical problems in enforcing the provisions here, and we would like to make our great commitment to that. We've done a lot of work at school level, and particularly leading up to the World Cup, all kinds of very creative things, cartoons and so on, that little children could even follow, bringing it to the attention of all our parishes. I did it in the whole diocese where I am, and there was a very significant response of the civil society sector in the whole Rustenburg area. Thank you.
Again, that will be the last question. And I could have to assume this is our technical back end. Okay. No, I just want to make sure that I've got all my resources so that I can make use of them. All right, good day.
Thank you, Jefferson. I would just like to refer to the branding with regard to Clause 13 that was mentioned here. I have a different view on it. I think we mustn't see the certificate handed to victims of trafficking as a brand that we're branding them. It is important, as far as I'm concerned, because it is a protective measure that's been put in place to ensure that those people are not exploited maybe once again. So this is just my very short and simple view, that we mustn't, you know, call it branding, just stay away from the word branding, you know, as if the certificates, we all have certificates, we have our IDs to prove we South Africans and all of it. And maybe this measure that's been put in place is actually there to further protect victims of trafficking. So I don't think that we must really be over concerned about and seeing it as branding of a victim of trafficking. Thank you, Chairperson.
I don't want to consider that much of a question, because I can see it within the committee. It's a grey area during consideration. When we debate, it will have to be resolved. I don't want to make it your burden. You have got advocates already inside. So stay safe on that. Can we thank you?
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Thank you very much for a very efficient, in terms of time, efficient presentation. Security studies, I'm sure they won't be efficient. Where are they? I thought by the time security studies would long be here.
Okay, thank you very much. We've actually prepared joint submissions between the Women's Legal Center and the Institute for Security Studies. I'm Mushaida Adhikari from the Women's Legal Center, and my colleague Annette Hübschler from the Institute for Security Studies. Okay. Essentially, trafficking in persons clearly violates a number of rights.
Just a second. I just want to draw the attention of the committee to the fact that as our multidisciplinary team is here, we've got the Justice Department, NPA, SAPS, and Social Development. In case you want to scrap some things around, all right, proceed.
Okay, thank you. Trafficking... Fine. Okay, trafficking clearly violates a number of rights set out in our Constitution. What we've done with our submissions is to focus quite carefully on some of the legal provisions that have been drafted in the bill. We have submitted quite extensively redrafted suggestions. I won't be going through them word for word. I'll just be highlighting what we have submitted, and hopefully you have copies of what we've submitted, and we can perhaps discuss them as we go along. Now, any effective anti-trafficking strategy requires... An effective detection and prosecution of trafficking is vital to any anti-trafficking strategy, but policing responses alone can't address the fundamental root causes of trafficking. These include gender inequality, the demand for cheap labor, limited economic opportunities for women in source countries, discrimination, violence, and abuse. An effective anti-trafficking strategy must be grounded in a human rights approach that leads us to encourage an integrated and survivor-centered approach. We must include progressive and fair migration policies, effective labor protections for vulnerable workers, and increased opportunities for socioeconomic development. Now, our submission will deal with the following sections of the bill, and we'll go through them bit by bit. However, before we get there, we'd just like to highlight a few preliminary issues. As other people stated before, no costing appears to have been undertaken for this bill, and we'd like to call upon this committee to insist that the cost of implementing the bill be calculated before the finalization of the bill. We're particularly concerned with some of the implications for the Department of Social Development, which in this version of the bill is responsible for conducting investigations in countries of origins of victims of trafficking to ensure that they can be repatriated. We welcome the bill as it operationalizes our country's commitment to combating all forms of trafficking, as well as complying with our international legal obligations to do so. We, however, do believe that we should be cautious about passing an act that may be too costly to implement fully and therefore cause further victimization to victims of trafficking. With regards to the preamble, we want to recommend that the second statement of the preamble, which is up there, be amended slightly. At present, we know that there's no evidence on which to base the preamble statement that there's an increase in human trafficking in South Africa. We simply don't have sufficient baseline data to determine the trends of trafficking in our country at present. We believe that it is sufficient for the legislation to refer to the concern of the country about the phenomenon without qualifying that by saying that there is an increase. There's insufficient evidence to suggest that there's a particular reason to believe that women and children are disproportionately victims of trafficking in our country, or that organized crime groups are involved in all cases of human trafficking, although this is a common perception. We therefore propose that the preamble statement be amended as we've set out in our submissions. Moving on to the definitions, we want to emphasize the need for precise and unambiguous definitions to facilitate effective prosecution and policing. Clear criminal law definitions are essential to the rule of law to ensure that the rights of both victims and perpetrators or defendants are protected, and we'd like to recommend the following definitional amendments. The current definition of exploitation is drafted very widely, and we believe that the potential for confusion exists if it's not tightened up. The definition should be flexible enough so that the courts can use it to remedy the variety of abusive conduct practiced by traffickers without being so wide that it is open to challenge. We have therefore recommended that exploitation be redrafted as follows: to include slavery or similar practices, exploitation of the prostitution of others, other forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor or services, servitude or the removal of organs. The definition of forced marriage is also slightly problematic. If you read the definition together with the definition of exploitation and trafficking, this could lead to the traditional practice of a kutwala being criminalized as a form of trafficking. Now, we believe that the practice of forced marriage should be dealt with in a separate statute which takes into account the social, economic, cultural, and religious context of forced marriage in South Africa and clearly defines when the practice ceases to be elopement by consent and when it becomes abduction or forced marriage. The current definition, however, if the committee decides to retain forced marriage in the statute, we'd like to point out that the current definition is drafted in such a way that it requires the valid consent of both parties to be absent before forced marriage can be established. So, for example, if the husband were to consent but not the wife, this would not constitute forced marriage under the current definition. And we believe that the lack of consent of any of the parties to the marriage should constitute a forced marriage. We have therefore recommended a redrafted definition as set out in our submissions, which takes into account these issues. The definition of sexual exploitation, read together with the definition of exploitation and trafficking as they're currently drafted, deems all forms of adult sex work to be trafficking. In addition, Section 3B of the bill deems consent to be irrelevant and therefore explicitly encompasses voluntary sex work. Now, an approach which conflates trafficking with sex work renders all sex workers as victims and ignores the economic and social context for sex work. Although the term trafficking is relatively broad in meaning, the interventions that governments have promoted have tended to historically reduce trafficking to either the transporting of women and girls for sex work or to sex work itself. Now, the question of raids and rescue operations has been a constant source of concerns for human rights activists. Raids often are carried out arbitrarily, focused almost exclusively on brothel districts and on arresting sex workers, regardless of whether or not there's actually any evidence of them having been trafficked. These anti-trafficking initiatives reproduce assumptions about women as passive, incapable of decision-making, and in need of protection. These types of initiatives are frequently used, however, as a facade to deter the entry of certain categories of migrants or to clean up establishments within the sex industry. And this agenda relies on seeing sex work as exceptionally dangerous and exploitative, and on seeing heightened state-sponsored border controls and urban policing as the solution to the issue. We therefore recommend that sexual exploitation be redrafted in the bill to include those who are participating in sex work, sexual servitude, or the production of pornographic materials as a result of being subjected to false, deception, fraud, and among other things. Would you, however, want to caution that in the absence of any of these factors, where the person participating in sex work is under the age of 18, it should be deemed to be sexual exploitation, and that we think would provide sufficient protection for children. The definition of trafficking in this version of the bill is much expanded from the previous version, and this current definition is broadened to such an extent that, in our view, it's neither practical nor clear. If this definition were to be accepted into legislation, all sex workers would become trafficking victims, and thus all sex workers should receive the same benefits and support as victims of trafficking, and all brothel owners should be prosecuted as traffickers. Even more seriously, all newspapers and internet services that carry personal advertisements for adult sex services, such as those we see in the classified advertisements in our daily newspapers, would be prosecuted under the bill for offences involving sexual trafficking of persons as set out in Section 4 of the bill. In addition, the broad scope of the definition would imply that any woman who is married and for whom her partner has paid lobola and who is then exploited by her husband or raped by her husband would be a victim of trafficking. The same would be the case for Ukutwala. It's our submission that the definition of trafficking should be very clear in terms of the practices that it seeks to criminalize, and that's specific while not creating impossible conditions for the determination of cases of trafficking. A clear, simple, and accurate definition for trafficking is more likely to result in successful prosecution and identification of victims than the convoluted and circular definition that is currently in the bill. We proposed a much simpler definition. It's very similar to the definition found in the U.S. Anti-Trafficking Act, and that particular definition has been sufficient for the United States to prosecute several cases of trafficking. Moving on to Chapter 2, which deals with prevention and combating of trafficking in persons, we want to highlight that we should be very cautious about providing awareness raising in the absence of evidence of exactly who is vulnerable and what they need to know to protect themselves against abuse. So, for example, materials that merely warn rural girls and women to be aware of job opportunities in the cities could have the effect of severely constraining their options for work seeking. It's our submission that there is currently insufficient evidence about who is particularly vulnerable or at risk of becoming a trafficking victim, nor is there sufficient evidence to allow for generalizations about the common recruitment techniques of traffickers in South Africa. The evidence that does exist is largely anecdotal and therefore cannot inform effective profiling. We recommend that the committee consider removing the current section or modifying it as such to allow that the intersectoral committee is able to make anti-trafficking programs and information after consultation with NGOs and after considering the evidence presented in trafficking cases. Moving on to Chapter 3, the Offences and Penalties section. Now, Section 81A requires that all potential lessors of premises conduct investigations into potential lessees which would fall outside of the normal scope of knowledge that an ordinary private or commercial lessor can reasonably expect it to have. The terms facilitate and promote are not defined in the bill, and the manner in which this section is currently drafted could result in lessors unlawfully violating the rights of privacy of innocent lessees or potential lessees in order to prevent prosecution for offences under the bill. We recommend that the level of mens rea or intent required for this offence be more explicitly set out in order to prevent innocent third parties being held liable for offences. The section also doesn't provide protection from civil liability for persons who report suspected offences erroneously but in good faith, and it also doesn't make provision for confidential reporting of offences, potentially opening people who report offences to retribution from traffickers. And we have recommended that the section be redrafted to take account of these concerns. Our concerns regarding Section 81B are similar to those referred to previously. It requires publishers, broadcasters, and distributors not only to exercise direct control over the content of material published, but also requires them to have knowledge of the manner in which the information will be put to use in circumstances that can't reasonably be within their sphere of knowledge. It requires persons who would have no direct control over the content of information, such as printers and points of sale, to exercise control over the content of material. Again, the level of intent or mens rea for the commission of the offence is not clearly set out and could potentially result in innocent third parties being held liable for offences. We believe that this section particularly is meant to prevent the promotion and incitement of trafficking and trafficking-related offences through the use of the media. We recommend that the bill set out the elements of the crime of incitement with specific reference to trafficking and trafficking-related offences. And we've included an explanation of what our current law on incitement is, and we believe that this is sufficient to cover the issue. And we believe that if the committee accepts the redrafted sections, section 8.2 would become superfluous, as internet service providers and many others who are not included in the sections would in fact be covered by the offences as set out in our submissions. With regards to identification and protection of victims, we're concerned that section 13.1a provides for a closed list of persons who have a duty to report suspected trafficking of adults. Anyone outside of that closed list merely has an option to report suspected adult trafficking. This is in contrast with Section 12, which places a duty on all persons who suspect child trafficking to report this to the police, and we can see no reason why a similar duty shouldn't exist in respect of adult victims. The effective detection and prosecution of trafficking requires the cooperation of all members of society, and we therefore have recommended that Section 13.1a be redrafted to take account of these suggestions. 13.1b provides for adult victims of trafficking to exercise their rights of privacy to a limited extent by allowing certain medical, social, and other service providers to obtain their written consent for reporting a reasonable suspicion of trafficking. And we commend the drafters in taking this approach. However, we recommend that the bill include safeguards to ensure that valid, informed consent is obtained. We have suggested a definition for informed consent, which takes into account the procedures that will be followed, explains the precise nature of the medical and other personal information that will be disclosed to authorities, and explains the possible risks involved in filing a report, and gives people the information that they require, that they can then withdraw the consent before filing, and that a precise prescribed consent form be signed by them. We'd like to draw the attention of the committee to the fact that the bill doesn't make any provision regarding what should happen to an individual who is initially identified as a possible victim of trafficking, but who may not be classified after investigations are completed. Such a person may, for example, be a victim of abuse or exploitation, but not necessarily a victim of trafficking. In such cases, they may be subjected to traumatic questioning by police and then be summarily deported. We submit that a section of the bill be included to ensure that such persons are provided with assistance and support from appropriate government departments. With regards to the status of foreign victims of trafficking, we're concerned that Section 19 places an onus on the victim of trafficking to prove that they may be harmed, killed, or trafficked again if they are returned to their country of origin. Now, on a purely practical level, placing the onus on the victim to prove this would require that they have access to resources and information which would simply be outside of what is readily acceptable to private individuals. We think that the Department of Home Affairs would be in a much better position in respect of access to resources, information, and intelligence sources to be able to assist persons to prove that they may or may not be victims of trafficking. And we believe that placing this onus on the individual, him or herself, would amount to an unfairly onerous burden. We believe that the assessment of harm or danger should be done on an objective basis by the Department of Home Affairs in a similar manner to that which is used in making determinations in respect of refugees and asylum seekers. We've set out in our submissions how hearings should be conducted, taking into account the requirements of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. With regards to compensation, the bill allows victims of trafficking to claim compensation from their traffickers. Our concern with the section is that the manner in which it's set out doesn't necessarily take into account the fact that the ordinary civil damages procedures in the magistrates' courts and the High Court could potentially allow traffickers to find out personal information about their victims. For example, if you look at Section 27.3b and 27.4d, now, while we support the need for compensating victims of trafficking and to allow them to hold their traffickers accountable, we caution against a system which doesn't protect victims and doesn't allow them to file for compensation in a manner which protects their identity and whereabouts. We believe that compensation of victims could be more manageable through a more general victim of crime compensation fund, which could be funded from proceeds of crime. The South African Law Reform Commission are currently looking at precisely this issue. regards to deportation and repatriation of victims, Section 30, Subsection 3 allows for voluntary repatriation of adult victims of trafficking. Now, given the concerns around the abuse of voluntary repatriation procedures in respect of asylum seekers by immigration officials, we recommend that additional safeguards be put in place in order to prevent similar abuses taking place in respect of trafficking victims. We recommend that a definition of voluntary repatriation be inserted into the bill, which allows people who want to be voluntarily repatriated to be informed of the various procedures that will happen, the risks and consequences of them perhaps being harmed on their return to their country, or the risk of prosecution on the return to their country, and also advises them of the various social, legal, and other protections offered by the Act. Section 30.3 also purports to allow victims of repatriation to be sent back to countries from which they have been trafficked. Now, we want to point out that victims of trafficking are sometimes trafficked through various countries en route to their final destination, and care should be taken to ensure that victims are only repatriated to countries where they have a legitimate right of residence. And we've suggested a redrafted section to take account of this. With regards to Chapter 9, the general provisions, Section 36, which deals with national instructions and directives, should be shortened and simplified. In its current form, it requires SAPS, the Home Affairs, Labour and the NDPP to each come up with their own set of national instructions. So our submission that while there clearly are agency or department-specific issues that should be dealt with by those specific departments, cross-cutting issues such as the manner in which victims of trafficking must be identified, interviewed and treated should be formulated by the Intersectoral Committee. We basically have set out a very long and redrafted section which takes into account what the Intersectoral Committee should do and how these directives should be dealt with by different departments. Finally, with regards to Chapter 10, the application of the Act, Regulation 43.2A requires the Minister of Social Development to make regulations concerning certain issues which we believe fall outside of their area of competence, and we believe that those would better be dealt with by Justice, NPA and SAPS together with Home Affairs. Section 41 sets out the functions of the Intersectoral Committee, and one of the issues that we're quite keen about is the integrated information system. However, we are concerned that no provision has been made for a secretariat or a similar body to assist with the running of that information system, and no department is specifically tasked with running and managing the information system. We would suggest that the Department of Justice or the NPA be tasked with managing the information, collecting data, and analyzing the data as well. And I think I've reached the end of my time, but essentially that's pretty much what we have to say.
Honourable members, Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Swartz, yes?
Wow, Mr. Chairman, what a presentation. Thank you very much. I think one must remark on how much content has been delivered to us in such a small time, and praise the presenter, both for the presentation and the written presentation. There are 1,000 questions in which one would wish to engage the presenter. Yes, but I won't do so. So over and above, first we can do that when we actually discuss the bill, if they will be kind enough to continue their engagement with us. But a few basic questions. On this issue of Nkutuala, if I pronounce it correctly, has been with us for a long time. And I need protection from the cruelty of the chair. Now, it's been with us for a long time. I thought that when I read the bill, I had exactly the same thing in mind, and I thought, haha, that's a good way of dealing with it without having to stick ends in hot water to put out a very hot political potato. But you come and says, no, don't do it now, do it with special legislation, which very likely you know won't be passed. Why would you do that? Why would you suggest that? Then on the bill, and I'll try to be short, I was want to step back to the convention, and I want to place on record, Mr. Chairman, that there were two delegations which went to sign the convention, Home Affairs and Justice. I was in charge of Home Affairs. Justice was the Minister Maduna and the DG Piccoli. We as Home Affairs were carried an instruction to express a reservation on the permanent residence requirement for victim of trafficking. But we were overruled by Justice in that respect. So Justice made a Home Affairs decision, which now we have inherited. So the and what it seems to me, looking at the language of the convention, this falls short. It seems that we are trying to regain some space in respect of Home Affairs, which the convention doesn't enable us to do. Because what we are saying here, the convention basically tells you, if these are victims of trafficking, take care of them, accommodate them, don't kick them out. But we give them a permit, which is a visitor permit, in which they cannot work. They can only go sightseeing or conduct businesses and act as business people. And then they need to leave. So it's not against deportation, but against summary deportation. So we give them 90 days, so it's no longer a deportation, and we invented this category of summary deportation. So this is a concern that I don't know whether you have looked at. The second concern is that you're right on the costing, but also there is no RIA on this bill. There is no regulatory impact analysis. Is it feasible for social development to try to do something that immigration, the refugee boards have failed to do over 30 years? And the question that I asked before, are we not finding, again, the situation where in order to assist 10 victims, we are going to create a system which is going to abuse by 100 people who are not going to, should not qualify just because their administrative capacity doesn't exist to prove that the situation doesn't warrant it, as it happened with refugee affairs.
Thank you, Chair. And again, I share those sentiments about the technical qualities, and I'll engage, go into a lot more detail once we've digested your inputs. But just on a more general note, you seem to indicate that there is insufficient evidence to suggest there's a particular reason to believe that women and children are disproportionately victims of trafficking. Now, there is that human science research report that does indicate that women constitute the largest group of victims in all streams of trafficking. And this is borne out by findings of the United Nations. I'm just curious as to why you should indicate that there are obviously men that are also trafficked for illegal mining and purposes, but it seems the greatest proportion is women and children, and maybe you could just add to that. And in the realm of organized crime, clearly they're not involved in all cases, but that report also highlights the role that organized crime is playing. Your proposal on the preamble is acceptable, but I just wondered on what basis you made those initial suppositions. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Honorable Ngosi?
Thank you, Chief Edwin. On page 17, where you're commenting on compensation, the last paragraph, you say you caution against a system which does not have built-in measures to protect victims of trafficking when they want to claim for compensation. What exactly do you mean by that? How do you make a claim against a person and expect that person not to know your identity?
Jeff?
Thanks. Just going to the definition of exploitation and what you are wanting dropped. And the one just to get clarity on, child labor. I don't know if you feel that's covered by forced labor. And then the issue of the impregnation of a female person against her will for the purposes of selling the child. Why did you want those removed? You complained that the definition was too broad, but those are quite specific aspects.
back to you now.
Okay. Well, with regards to why Kutwala should be dealt with in specific legislation and not trafficking, is that we feel that there's a specific context in which it happens in this country. It's not trafficking. And we feel that it's quite a little bit sneaky to try and deal with something which should be dealt with on a more broader social level and which would require proper consultation with affected communities through trafficking legislation. We just felt that it doesn't always amount to trafficking, and we want to maintain this legislation to deal specifically with the trafficking issues. With regards to your reservations on the permanent residence issues, I don't know that there's an answer. I hear you, having spent many, many, many years doing refugee work and interacting with the Refugee Appeal Committee, and I think I've got a few wrinkles dealing with that committee. So I hear your frustrations with regards to the system, and I think that it's not a question of the legislation being inappropriate. I think it's a question of there not being sufficient funding, not being sufficiently trained personnel, not being sufficiently stringent controls over how the system is managed. I think if you read even the Asylum Seekers Act, the Refugees Act, it's a great piece of legislation, but it's not being implemented, and I don't think that the issue is to change the legislation. I think the issue is to deal with the implementation issues, and those are slightly different issues. But again, recognizing that that is something that we as a country struggle with. We've got great legislation. The Domestic Violence Act is another example. Implementation is always a struggle. Right. How you protect victims of trafficking while they're making compensation claims. We recognize exactly that if you're going to make a claim against a specific individual, there's always going to be a danger of your identity being exposed, and that's why we suggest that compensation rather be handled through a victim of crime compensation fund, where you make the claim to the fund as opposed to making a claim against an individual trafficker. As I said, the South African Law Reform Commission is currently looking at proposals which deals with a compensation fund for all victims of crime, so you actually make the claim to the fund, and that then deals with the issue of you having to claim against the person who has perhaps abused you. With regards to why we took out some of the specific things in the definition of exploitation, what we felt was that we didn't want to constrain the definition too much. What we wanted to do was have a broad definition which could cover a number of issues which were not necessarily put in the Act, as well as creating a definition which would allow prosecutors to effectively prosecute offences.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say a couple of words on the extent of a human trafficking question that has been raised quite a few times, also with regards to the role of women and men and children and the role of organized crime in the perpetration of trafficking. From the IFS perspective, we've been doing a lot of baseline studies on human trafficking and more specifically on organized crime for the last 5 years. And none of these studies has been conclusive in saying organized crime are the main perpetrators. In fact, one of our main findings was that in doing the research and dealing with a lot of different sources, there was a confusion between the smuggling of people and the trafficking of persons, which are two completely different phenomena. What we also then found is that going into research on trafficking, we go in with a lot of assumptions. And these are assumptions we find time and time again in UN conventions and other research studies, such as women and children being the preferred victims of trafficking and organized criminals being involved, and that there's certain vulnerabilities attached to certain groups of people. Now, when we did a regional study, we actually found that mostly it was men that were trafficked across borders for purposes of labor exploitation. This was a regional study. It wasn't specifically focused on South Africa, but Southern Africa. We also found that not necessarily organized crime syndicates were the perpetrators. Often families of the victims were involved in the trading of people. So So this is just some of the findings. And my colleague Chandra Gould has also done a study on the sex industry in Cape Town, where over 800 different people were interviewed from the sex industry, indoors and outdoors. And through hearsay, eight victims of trafficking were identified. And actually Cape Town had been identified as the epicenter of human trafficking in the whole of South Africa. So a quite broad-ranging study with random sampling showed 8 cases of trafficking. We found a lot of exploitation of women, and especially also at the hands of police and other officials, as highlighted by the Catholic Bishops' Conference earlier. But we couldn't specifically say it is such a big phenomenon as it's an explosion. So for us to say the preamble should be carefully phrased is based on that there are too many assumptions and we don't have research-based evidence to make such assumptions.
So you wanted to make a quick follow-up?
Yes, and I wanted to find out if therefore the ISS and the Women's Legal Center are suggesting that the perpetrators of this crime must be absolved from paying towards the compensation of the victims.
No, not
if
at all.
They are to rely on the compensation fund for crimes of, for
right.
victims of crime.
Not at all. What we are saying is until the Victims of Crime Fund comes into place, there should be sufficient protections to allow people to make compensation. We have the Asset Forfeiture Unit, which allows the seizure of assets which have been used in the commission of crime. We would suggest that those Asset Forfeiture Unit seizures be used to fund the proceeds of crime. And I think, you know, our concern mainly is just to ensure that the protection of victims. If there aren't sufficient protections, they're not going to make those claims against their traffickers. And that's the only reason that we highlight that particular section.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry I had to move out a bit, but you seem to suggest in your submission that the issue of ubuthwala has nothing to do with gender inequality. Am I correct to say that?
What we're saying is that ubuthwala is not trafficking. Now, gender inequality, yes, but we believe that this is not the correct piece of legislation to deal with that. That's simply what we're saying.
Okay. Can I just move on a bit? Can you also, in your spare time, try and understand the issue of ubukhomba? Because most of you don't seem to touch on that. There's also an issue of ubukhomba in some of the churches, and we would like to hear more on that in future as well. Ubukhomba, yes, it happens a lot in churches. Do you just identify someone with a pretty face and you say, this one, I want this one. And the girl has no objection to that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm going to open a small can of worms, but sooner or later needs to be done. And I think it would be interesting. I'd like to elicit the presenters' opinions on the definition of exploitation and why it should not include labor rendered under conditions below minimum labor standards, because it's still under the definition of abuse of vulnerability, and that's the most common situation where somebody is an illegal immigrant, is brought here to work, and ends up working at terms and conditions which are below the minimum minimum labor standards, because it's illegal, because it's pregnant, all the cases of vulnerability. However, the definition of exploitation speaks about false labor, but falls short to addressing the most common of cases that I know of, which is exactly that of people working for peanuts, or sometimes even for food, just for food with no money, merely because they are illegal or they are in a vulnerable situation.
Abundance, you are the last here.
I am so grateful to you, Chairperson. Just to take Ingutwala, Ugutwala, and Wukomba a little further, arranged marriages, where a child of 4 years old, parents meet with another child of 6 years of age, and these parents agree that these two children at some point will marry. Do you regard that as trafficking? And if you don't, why not?
Okay. Right. With regards to the question, firstly, thank you for highlighting that issue. We will definitely come and chat to you about it. With regards to the issue of exploitative labor practices, the current labor law definitions deal with some of those issues. If you look at what we've suggested, we suggest that exploitation includes slavery or practices similar to slavery, and we believe that that could cover the potentially the situation that you're talking about, as well as forced labor or services. We believe that those are quite widely drafted to cover what you're talking about as well. And we do also believe that the current labor legislation deals with some of those things. But what we want to be quite cautious about is not using the trafficking legislation to fix all the ills of society. We must be quite clear about what it is that we want to achieve with this legislation. It is the movement, transport, harboring of persons for exploitative purposes. And I think that's the issue that we want to focus on. And again, the issue of arranged marriages, I think it's quite similar. Yes, where people are specifically brought into the country for arranged marriages, that's trafficking. But an arranged marriage, which doesn't necessarily include any of those other things, is not necessarily trafficking. And underage marriages are dealt with in other legislation. I think we must just be quite clear about what we want to achieve when we're dealing with trafficking legislation, that it requires the transfer, harboring, movement of persons for exploitative purposes.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well done. It means every point was wow. Well done. And I'm counting your time now as you are walking. Advise people that sometimes you don't have to make sure that you make your 20 minutes because you eat on your time to engage with us. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, I shall regard that as an invitation and not a challenge, and I shall attempt to finish well before the 20 minutes is up. Thank you. I'd like to thank members of the committee for the opportunity for us to present our submission. We haven't gone for the PowerPoint presentation. Our submission is very brief. It's just 2 pages, and it really makes one fundamental point. I was delighted to hear a member of the committee talk about opening a can of worms a little earlier, and I think it's true to say that in raising this issue, we are opening a second can of worms, but of course that is the work of the committee. The World AIDS campaign is a very unusual beast. We are a global HIV NGO with its main office in Cape Town in South Africa. I work as its global program manager, working in programs in Africa and in the Middle East, and also touching on Asia, Latin America. And my colleague, Brenny Adams, here, who has a long history of working in Parliament, is doing work with the emergent HIV/AIDS committee in the Parliament here. So we do some work in South Africa, some in Southern Africa, across Africa, and globally. And I know the committee is rightly concerned with the motivation of submitters and the information that we have and the knowledge and wisdom that we come with. And I just wanted to talk briefly about our organisation and then about my personal background. Our organisation is concerned that governments around the world deliver on their commitments around HIV, which include universal access to treatment, to prevention, to care, and to support. The reality of the message from around the world is that HIV programs do not always get through to the groups which are most vulnerable, and that's true in the statistics in South Africa as elsewhere. So, for example, men who have sex with men, many people who already have HIV, people who use drugs, and sex workers are particularly vulnerable to HIV, and the statistics so far as they exist prove that. So we are concerned that the law, the policy, and the practice in countries recognizes the role of those groups. We've recently been appointed by the United Nations Development Programme to work with them on a global commission on HIV and the law, which is looking precisely at those issues, and sex workers are included in that. My personal background, and it's particularly exciting for me to talk to this committee, at the end of 2008, voluntarily finished 12 years in the New Zealand Parliament. For 6 of those years, I chaired our Justice and Electoral Committee, which is the equivalent in that Parliament to your committee here. And also, in that role of being a Member of Parliament, I personally sponsored a piece of legislation called the Prostitution Reform Act, which eventually passed through the New Zealand Parliament and meant that New Zealand became the first country in the world to decriminalise sex work. Now, the relevance of all that, which is what the core of my submission deals with, is the dynamic, which other submitters have thankfully also referred to, the dynamic between sex work and trafficking. I want to first of all just very briefly mention the bill. I think this bill is excellent. I also think the committee is blessed with great submitters who know these issues in great detail and are providing lots of opportunities for the committee to further improve the bill. I think there was an issue around the definition of trafficking, which we refer to in point 5 of our submission. But the key point I wanted to make, and this does really, I think, involve the committee in some lateral thinking, but I'm not suggesting that the committee should try and change the world in the work it does on the bill, is that no one denies trafficking exists. Trafficking can only be successfully pursued if reliable information is getting to the authorities. And when one considers a story which is very recent in all our minds, which if you take your minds back to before the World Cup, there were articles internationally and in the South African media suggesting the very large numbers of people that were going to be trafficked into South Africa mainly for purposes of sex work. The numbers ranged from 100,000 to 40,000, and some didn't mention a figure. The police reported to Parliament a couple of weeks ago that they hadn't been able to identify one person who was trafficked for that purpose. Now, I'm not asserting either of those to be the case. What I'm asserting is that the truth is somewhere between the two. But I think that story clearly illustrates there was a fundamental problem in passing legislation around trafficking when a major reason, reportedly, through what research is available, a major reason for trafficking, which is around sex work, remains so much in the dark. And that's because South Africa sustains a law which criminalises sex workers and criminalises their clients as well, which puts South Africa among the countries that has the most heinous law in this respect. So even if this bill is further improved, and even if the Parliament then passes that, what I'm suggesting is that there's an impossible disjoint, because the police who have the responsibility for pursuing this legislation are also trying unsuccessfully to sustain a law which says we don't want any sex work at all in South Africa, and if you're a sex worker and if you're a client, you are therefore a criminal. So to me, that is creating an impossible disjoint. I'm not asking this committee to try and change the law on sex work, but it does seem to me that that fundamental point about how far the law that you are working on is actually going to be possible to implement on the ground, isn't just going to be law that looks nice and can't be implemented, is that there are a couple of things this committee could do to just acknowledge that point. One would be in any comments you put forward associated with the bill, without amending the text of the bill, is just to recognise the fact that this Parliament has a duty, most recently stated in the Constitutional Court in 2002, when they addressed the very issue of the legal status of sex work and decided it is not for this court to pass judgment on the effectiveness or otherwise of the choice made by the legislature in criminalising sex work. They said that in a democracy, those are decisions that must be taken by the legislature and the government of the day and not by the courts. That was 8 years ago. 7 years ago, the South African Law Reform Commission was given the job by government of looking at the issue, and to this date, they have not produced a final report on the issue. Most recently, it was going to be produced by March this year, and yet again has been delayed. So what I'm asking the committee is, firstly, to make reference to the fact that the status of sex work needs to be sorted, because if you imagine a different environment, such as we had in New Zealand, where the police's job was to protect sex workers from harm rather than attempting to implement a law which criminalises sex workers, you completely reform that key relationship between the police and the sex workers. And that is the environment, as was proven in New Zealand, where sex workers who are legitimately working, who find out about workers who have been trafficked in, are feel able to go to the police without turning themselves in automatically as criminals, and without also threatening the trafficked worker in the same way. So that's something you can't write into law. This is just a concept that I hope the committee can get their heads around. And then secondly, I did suggest in, I think the bill's been renumbered, but it's actually under Chapter 9 of the bill, National Instructions and Directives, four changes so that when various government departments, police, immigration, labour, and prosecuting authorities are reporting on the effectiveness of the bill, that they report specifically on the impact of the legal status of sex work on the ability of those different departments to identify and resolve cases of trafficking for the purposes of sex work. So what that's doing, even if we don't manage to achieve better law on sex work, what that's doing is to make it incumbent on the authorities responsible for implementing this law that they actually look at that issue. And if they find that the fact that sex workers are, by South African law, all labelled as criminal, and as you've heard in earlier, from earlier submitters, that leads to widespread, proven, researched abuse of sex workers, that even if that is still the case, that those authorities have to look at that issue and might, I would hope, report back that an illegal sex work industry is not the way to try and get effective anti-trafficking law. And that's the fundamental point I've made and suggested two ways in which the committee could progress that. Mr. Chair. Under 20 minutes, I hope.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your...
Mazen, is your proceed?
Chair, thank you. Clearly, we won't have a lot of discussions on this issue, but I, from my side, differ fundamentally from your suggestions. May I firstly say that when we considered the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill, certain proposals were made. That bill introduced infant provisions to deal with trafficking, and we as a committee then went further and criminalised clients as well. So there is a very strong sentiment. The sentiment might have changed, but from our side we fundamentally differ from that. There is also, obviously, one needs to look at the issue of widespread abuse of sex workers and that, but for us at this stage to consider putting into a resolution the decriminalisation of sexual work is far-reaching, considering the fact that the SA Law Commission is busy working on that, and it isn't an issue that we've asked inputs for this purpose. So that is just my comments on your proposal. Thank you, Chair.
So wonderful to speak after the Mr. Chairman, after the esteemed colleague, highly admired, and there's such a sharp disagreement with him. First of all, I wish to congratulate the New Zealander colleague and envy him for the right he has to introduce legislation in his parliament. I had to take the speaker to court to regain that right and regain it for all the members of this parliament, and the action is pending. Welcome. You have the right to introduce legislation. But being as it may, sorry, I couldn't resist. I wholeheartedly agree that the criminalization of sex workers was really the elephant in the corner, and the preceding presenter made the same point, that this will compound the real problem that exists in this country, over and above the problem of trafficking, which is that of exploitation of sex workers, abuse of sex workers, lack of protection of sex workers, because of prohibitionism, that's what it is, and prohibitionism leads to those consequences, and this will feed into that, and I think it is a welcome opportunity to regain it. Now, criminalizing sex has been in the agenda of many people through the millennia, and criminalizing sex workers is the point of entry for the agenda, and criminalizing sex is real, as we have seen it, people get in many parts of the world get killed because of sex. And freeing sex is the duty and agenda of, I think, any civilized society. So I do agree with the sentiments, and I think as a committee we must take this issue very seriously.
So, between Honourable Swartz and Honourable Amosim, that is a draw.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, when it comes to the objects of the Act, there is a submission made now that it lacks clarity, and I think it's important to say, you know, what is the clarity that these objects lack? And I think we have taken into consideration when it comes to defining sex grooming and abuse within the definitions when it comes to sex grooming and abuse. They speak within the... They speak under trafficking, and I think a person can look at that. You know what would mean. Let us leave that to the committee itself. But I think we need clarity.
Your response.
Thank you for picking up on that point in our submission, and I think, as I said, others have gone into more detail about the definitions, and that's absolutely the job of the committee to do that. I also respect the fact that a committee in another parliament made a decision to criminalise clients, and it's a decision of the parliament, and I respect that, but I think there was a tension between advocating that and then condemning the abuse of sex workers when they're working in an entirely illegal environment. Because then when a sex worker is abused, and if they go to report that to the police, and they are automatically, by doing that, coming out as a criminal, I think most people would accept there is a problem there, and I don't think that problem is dealt with until the legal status of sex work is addressed. I'm not suggesting for one moment that this committee should put in its comments on the bill that sex work should be decriminalised. What I am saying, or suggesting, is that the committee might consider that 8 years since the Constitutional Court said Parliament, it's your job to address this issue, and 7 years since the South Africa Law Commission, which may be busy working on it, but they've been busy for 7 years, and I've appeared before them, and I didn't get much impression that there was an awful lot happening there fast on these issues, because it's so politically awkward, and because they in a sense, need to know that there's some political buy-in to progressing things, that maybe it's the job of Parliament to say, we've waited a long time, this bill is clearly not going to work as effectively as it should unless we deal with the issue of sex work law, and we as Parliament think that issue should be picked up. That's all I'm asking, that it be addressed and mentioned in some way, not that you advocate for a model which will take years of discussion. In New Zealand we decriminalised, and South Africa, as I suggested, will come up with its own model in its own way.
Are you finished?
Person, trafficking was answered, but when it comes to the objects of the act, that is circular and lacks clarity. What do they mean by that? Because if I picked up the sexual grooming and abuse, no one has picked up that, but they did not tell us when it comes to the objects of the act. You know, what is it that lacks clarity? He spoke to the definition, but not the object. Thank you.
Oh, it's really the same point. I mean, I think the lack of clarity is on the use of the word term sexual grooming and abuse, and they're not defined clearly in the bill. And I think if those words are used in legislation, that they need to be defined. So in the tidying up of Chapter 1, then that needs to be dealt with. So that's the point we're making there. So absolutely supporting the legislation, but the definition of trafficking needs to be very clear. And when I read Chapter 1, as someone who spent years in the Parliament reading law, and particularly when I read the definition of trafficking, it didn't leap out as being particularly clear. So I just think it's important at the end of the committee's work that the committee goes back to that definition of trafficking to make sure that it really does work effectively.
I'm not going to have a dialogue, but when I thought when it comes to that paragraph, the objects of the act should be taken out. You know where they got it in that paragraph? But on page...
Can I do?
Yeah.
Is it correct that the Law Commission has been going for 7 years on this issue of sex work? 7 years? Are they here? Are they here? Yeah? 7 years?
It just goes to show how difficult the subject is, Chair. I'm not from the Law Commission, I'm from the department, but it's correct. But it is correct to say that they have been busy for some time with the subject. They've had many workshops, many discussions with all role players, and we expect a report pretty soon.
Open a discussion within ourselves again. I think we should be uncomfortable. 7 years is quite. This debate has been there since time immemorial. I don't think it's correct for our technical people. They must table this thing before Parliament. Let Parliament take a decision on the matter. It's not for them to take a decision. They have made their investigations. I think the department will help us on the matter. Yes.
Chair, I will convey your sentiments to the chair of the Law Commission.
We're curious to know where are they with regard to this. I have not expressed a view.
People are saying no. Now, that's their problem. They're the reform commission. When they hear this, they say, what do you want? Legalize, people say no.
They have to issue a report.
I am always wary of leaders who have got things they are scared to speak about. Because leadership is about leading about everything that is happening in an area that you are leading. So my understanding is that law commissions would interact with Parliament for different purposes. Amongst others, is progress with regard to that investigation and challenges if there are any. Probably during that interaction, maybe Parliament can say we advise this direction and so on. So that means, but after 7 years, what are they doing for 7 years? Yeah? So let's leave it at that point. I think we are 30 minutes ahead of time, but there's nothing you can do. You know, for instance, if it was possible to shorten time, I would take an advantage and say, if, for instance, you have, as we speak, what is this? If you have law for human rights, we would say, without question, they should just do a presentation, and then we will come back. Are they here? Can you take the stage? Yeah, so that we've got another time to make use of here. Because I don't want people to loiter around. No. We don't want to loiter around, Honorable Thompson. Take not more than 20 minutes and then we go for lunch. And then we can have another few minutes to loiter.
Thank you, Chair. It's always an advantage to be the last person doing the submissions just before lunch. So I'd like to try and give an assurance that we are trying to use up our time effectively. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to make these submissions on BP. Thank you, Chair. Thank you again for the opportunity to make these submissions on B7 of 2010, the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Bill. Just briefly about Lawyers for Human Rights and the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa. My name is Sheldon McGarty. I'm the Regional Director of Lawyers for Human Rights in the Western Cape. And our organization does a fair amount of work involving the rights of undocumented migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. And the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa is an advocacy body that deals with many of these issues. To then just kick in straight into the aspects of our submission, I won't keep you for much longer on just the background and the context of it. I think there's been a number of submissions that have sketched the background to the need for this bill. So I'll just go straight into the various submissions we make on specific aspects of the bill. Firstly, in regard to the definition, as the committee would have heard, there's been a number of concerns raised around the adequacy of the definition. And essentially what the approach of the draft legislation has seemed to take has been to really have what I would call a catch-all form of definition, which on the face of it does seem to have certain advantages where one is then able to bring various forms of conduct within the ambit of that bill. The disadvantage of that, in our view, is that it does create some difficulties where a number of forms of conduct are subject to a criminal prohibition, and it could potentially raise problems in the effective prosecution of offences in terms of this bill. As the committee would be aware, that there are two types of offences in the bill, the key offences being the offence of trafficking itself and as well as the offence of involvement in trafficking. And our view is that the current scope of the definition would need to be narrowed essentially to provide for the proper prosecution, the effective prosecution of offences in terms of this bill. And we would therefore align ourselves with the submission of the Institute for Security the Institute for Security Studies and the Women's Legal Centre, which suggests that the definition be shortened to provide for a definition that that is workable and that is in line that is in alignment with other jurisdictions that have dealt with similar issues. The next aspect of our submission deals with the provisions of Section 9, and Section 9 deals with the liability of carriers. And our submission on this is that we accept that there is a need for liability to be imposed on carriers and transportation companies that are in many instances directly involved in the trafficking of persons. But what we do point out is that there is already provision in the Immigration Act, for example, that does provide for the imposition of liability in these circumstances. But the other aspect of that of Section 9, which should be taken into account, which we don't deal with directly in our submission, so I'll just make a small point on this, is that what the section provides for is that the carrier is subject to liability if they know that the victim of trafficking does not have a passport. Now, practically, you may have substantial difficulties in establishing on the facts of a particular case that the carrier knew that these particular persons did not have valid travel documents. And a possibility that the committee may want to consider there is whether that provision ought to be redrafted to include a provision whereby if a carrier knew or ought reasonably to have known that these persons were not in possession of valid travel documents, then the liability of the carrier would then arise. Insofar as Section 11 is concerned, and what Section 11 provides for is various factors to be considered in the sentencing of persons that have been found guilty of offences. And we recommend that one of the aspects that needs to be considered there is any submissions which the victim of trafficking may want to make for the court in order to consider its decision. Moving then on to Chapter 4, and the first aspect that we deal with here is Section 13. And what Section 13 provides for is a certificate which is issued to the victim of trafficking. Now, it does provide for that certificate to be in the as prescribed by regulation, but it's not entirely clear which is the issuing authority for that certificate, whether it's the Department of Home Affairs or some other relevant departments. And related to that aspect is that it's not also clear whether the effect of the certificate itself will provide the holder of the certificate with an immigration status. We do accept that the bill does provide for various permits, a visitor's permit and a permanent residence permit to be issued in certain circumstances to the victim of trafficking. But initially it will be this particular certificate that will be provided, and our view is that the committee should consider whether the actual legal implications of the certificate, whether it provides an immigration status or whether the holder will also need to apply for an additional status to remain in the country. Now, the context and the importance of that is that if the certificate doesn't provide a mechanism for the holder of that certificate to have a very clear legal status, it could render the victim of trafficking subject to arbitrary arrest as an illegal foreigner in terms of the Immigration Act. And obviously the consequences of that and the re-traumatization of that victim are consequences that will arise if that person is arrested in terms of the Immigration Act and on the basis that they don't have possession of valid documents. Now, our submission also focuses largely on issues relating to child victims of trafficking. And what the bill does provide for in Section 14 is for the child to be assisted to apply for asylum or to remain in the country for the duration of the children's court order. And our view is that the bill need not necessarily limit the child victim of trafficking's rights in that regard only to access to the children's court system or to the right to apply for asylum in terms of the Refugees Act. There's also a related difficulty that arises for the duration of the children's court process. Now, one of the problems that we found in practice is that very often minors reach the age of majority while that process, which is often beset by bureaucratic delays, is underway. So it leaves one with the situation where a child is the subject of a children's court inquiry process and then would reach the age of majority. And then in the absence of there being legal certainty about what the rights are of the child after that period, there could be the possibility of uncertainty and further trauma of that victim of child trafficking. And what we recommend in that regard is that the board should make specific provision not just for assistance to the child insofar as the children's court process is concerned, or in relation to applying for asylum in terms of the Refugees Act, but also assistance in relation to the regularization of the status of that child in terms of other provisions of the Immigration Act. And we point out at page 6 and page 7 of the submission the various provisions in the Immigration Act, section 32B of the Immigration Act, which does provide for the Minister of Home Affairs to have a discretion to afford a foreign person the rights of permanent residence for a specific or unspecified period where there are special circumstances which exist. We also point out that there are provisions in the Citizenship Act which allow for citizenship for a child who is stateless and is born in the Republic, as well as the Refugees Act, which the bill does provide for. And we make a recommendation at page 7 of our submission for the redrafting of those sections in that regard. Insofar as section 15 of the bill is concerned, we are happy to see that the bill does specifically provide that a foreigner who is a victim of trafficking is entitled to the same public health care services as those to which the citizens of the Republic have access. And what's slightly unclear to us is exactly how this will work in principle. Very often what happens is that even if a person is issued with certain documents that show that are lawful documents in terms of the Immigration Act, when a person does go to a state facility and the officials see that this person is a foreigner on a visitor's visa, often the person is then subject to charges which a foreign tourist, for example, would have to pay if they're in the country. And we suggest it could be done possibly by way of regulations, whether the actual certificate that is issued in terms of Section 13 could be endorsed to that effect. And insofar as Section 18 is concerned, it's a similar point. We would recommend that from a practical point of view, with regard to the actual contents of the documents itself, that the visitor's permit be specifically endorsed for work and study purposes. Mr. Chair, those are our submissions. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to.
I think time allows us to take you out of the system so that we ask you questions. Just switch off your. Yes. It helps you to tell you. So some of us, a lot of us, we stay as single residents. So if we've got time to go home early, we take advantage of that so that we can cook. Do members want to file questions? Maybe even before the members move. Manier, sir. My curiosity, maybe even technical people can clarify me. The nature of question you raised around certificate presupposes that it's meant for foreigners. Are we talking about trafficking, transnational terms, or just trafficking? And I think that needs to be clarified. I thought there's just trafficking, whether you are a foreigner or not a foreigner. I thought this is what we're talking about. I need to be clarified. Because if we're talking about trafficking, is the illegality of trafficking, then you need to clarify the issue of certificate. Why do you seem to be referring it to foreigners? And there is another honorable member, Honorable Ambrosini, and another member, Honorable Kali.
Thank you, Chair. First, the general issue of the extent of trafficking in South Africa. Your first, on page 2, you indicate, you say then not one single trafficking case. That was, we the committee, in my mind, based that sentence on the feedback that we had in the committee. We received an input on the dedicated FIFA World Cup courts, 64 out of 750. In those courts, there was not one trafficking case. But clearly, there were cases in other jurisdictions during that time, and those cases are being investigated at the moment. I think your next sentence is probably more accurate, that you are concerned about whether this speaks to a serious problem about law enforcement's ability to identify and detect cases of trafficking. And I think that is exactly in line with the Human Science Research Council's findings on this whole issue. And I think it is probably more broader than we would like to. Morris Ongolora, that's going to make a submission, indicates 30,000 to 40,000 children involved in South Africa. So I think we need to understand that it is widespread in South Africa. The issue relates to detection and prosecution. Just then on a more specific issue, and that is that on page 5 you raised the issue of children that reach the age majority, and that is a very, very valid point. If you could just add to that where your experience once the child reaches the age of 18 and what happens to the status of that child, where they are not protected, may be deported as an illegal foreigner, and how we can address that. And I think that is a very, very valid... You indicate that there should be a mechanism outlined in this bill whereby child victims of trafficking are automatically assisted to apply for and receive immigration status and protection from arrest and deportation. So in your view, it's not covered sufficiently in the bill, and could you then possibly give us wording to improve that? You might want to, at the later stage, amplify your submission, because I think that's a very valid submission. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
I share the sentiments, and especially in my household, I need to do all the cooking myself, so I try to keep it. To combine two questions, if I may. Okay, question or comment. Let me start from the comment that the rest of you, Mr. Chairman. We are dealing with the implementation of the convention, which only deals with a transnational situation, which is addressed by each member state with reciprocity. We have extended this in this bill only to also to deal with trafficking within the country. But the main thrust of the convention and the bill, it's an international phenomenon, and I feel very uneasy in the fact that amongst all the presenters, we do not have experts from the Department of Home Affairs and the Refugee Board. Why the Refugee Board? Because the task is very similar, the investigation is very similar, and we could learn a lot about what they've not been able to do over the years, and gain a sense of whether any of this can be done. Then the second issue, arising from the presenter and what Mr. Schwartz said, that I would like to address, is my personal difficulties in legislating on the basis of something that we think it is a problem. It's got to be a problem. There must be a problem of this nature. All the other indications relating to children exploited in South Africa by South African are there, and therefore this must also exist. But without any hard evidence, when that hard evidence exists in other countries, in the United States it exists in Thailand, it exists, I mean, there are these things, people get found. And I wonder that to the extent to which we are not just reacting preemptively to what is an international trend, an international epidemic, which is not yet caught in South Africa, which turns to the problem of whether or not we really have the resources.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I want to check with the Human Rights Commission if in their previous submissions did they look at the issue of human trafficking regarding the removal of the body parts, because in most cases I mean, that is common within the country, and in most cases, people are dead by then. So regarding compensation, what happens in that? Because when the bill is passed, you will notice that there's going to be a gap in the law, and the family will not be compensated if it's not taken into consideration right now. Thanks.
Abumaka?
Thanks, Chair. Just a few things. Chair, while I'm well aware that the Lawyers for Human Rights have done this in association with the Institute for Migration, I would like to point out that human trafficking, one of the greatest scourges in our country, is human trafficking that occurs within our borders. And it's South African citizens that are human trafficked, for example, from Nelspruit to Cape Town or from Pretoria to Durban. And I think that Lawyers for Human Rights need to look slightly more in the actual internal human trafficking that happens in our country, because we focus very much on people coming in and out of our country, but we don't focus on the human trafficking that happens within our borders. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Then on your submission page 5, you say there appears to be no reason to limit the scope of means by which a child would be able to regularize their immigration status in the country. Well, of course there would be a limit, because you would have to look at the age of the child, because you further then go on to say that obviously this will be, if they reach majority during the time, then we would look at giving them status there. But it worries me what happens when you're dealing with children who are 11 and 12 years old. How are children of that age going to be able to make a rational decision as to whether they want to become South Africans or whether they want to go back to the country in which they were trafficked from? That's assuming they were trafficked in from another country. Then, again, on your report number 7, and please, you must not misunderstand me. I agree with what you're saying 100%. I just want to point out some practical problems. You recommend that the section be replaced with the following positions. A child who is a victim of human trafficking must be referred to a designated social worker for investigation. I want to point out that one of our biggest problems in our country, it's something that we're trying to address, is the fact that we do not have enough social workers. And there is an incredible amount of pressure being put on the Department of Social Development to increase these social workers. And social workers, I think, play such a pivotal role in South Africa, and importance isn't given to the work that these brave men and women do. So I just want to point out that while I agree with you, a practical problem will be is that there is a serious lack of social workers to deal with these children. And then in the same block, number 2, the last sentence says, if the child wishes to apply for asylum in terms of the Refugee Act, they must be assisted to do so. Now, where would these children stay during this time? Do you foresee these children becoming part of a system of fostering, going to a system of adoption, or staying in centres of care until they reach the age of 18? Because what I'm saying is, you know, already these children have gone through things that no child should ever go through. And I think we should be a little bit more elaborate as to where, you know, you intend these children to actually stay, because you could have a child at 11 and then would stay in a care centre for another 9 years, for example, or whatever the case may be. So, you know, we have to look at the practicality of how you deal with these children to limit the damage that's already been caused to them.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Chair, if I could just go back to the first point, and I think the issue there broadly is the focus of the bill around transnational trafficking of people. And clearly the bill has made that choice that it does provide for offences in relation to international trafficking of people as well as internally. And we think it's important that it has done that. So I think that deals with the first issue. Insofar as the focus of our submissions, we do accept that the major focus of our submissions has been in relation to our experience working with people that are refugees, undocumented migrants, and that have been either applying for asylum in South Africa or have been arrested on the basis that they're undocumented migrants. We do accept, and we think it's an important point, that this does happen internally. And for that reason, we would support the focus of the bill insofar as it does provide for this to not simply be a phenomena that is punished by the South African laws, where it happens with smuggling of people across our borders, but internally as well. And insofar as the second point is concerned, we do accept the point. I think it's an important one that and what we do point out at the beginning of our submissions is that much of the, for example, we do point out insofar as the World Cup was concerned, there was a lot of media hype around the extent of human trafficking of people, both both inside into South Africa for the purposes of the World Cup, and. At the end of the day, it does become a question around detection, as you rightly point out. The fact that there may not have been a number of prosecutions of these offences doesn't actually mean that it doesn't happen at all. And we do accept that as an important contextual factor. With regard to the specifics around our submissions relating to the rights of children and the problems that happen when they reach a majority status, now, I think most members of the committee will be aware of the serious problems insofar as delays with these procedures are concerned, both at the point where children are either referred to as social worker, as the committee member points out, the serious lack of there being an adequate number of social workers to deal with these problems, as well as the delays that happen in that process. My own experience in relation to children applying for foster care grants, for example, is that very often, you would see an average of a 2-year delay for that process to actually reach its endpoint, where a decision is actually made by the children's court. And what we say is that it's precisely for that reason that there must be provision made in the bill by way of some or other mechanism that protects a child from the time a child may arrive in South Africa smuggled from Tanzania or from Rwanda at the age of 11. By the time that child goes through the entire system, that child may be reaching the age of 16 or 17. During that period, we've often seen a situation where children arrive with other adults, and they are unaccompanied minors. They often then stay with members of that particular community where other persons from that particular country. So there's often that major delay, and that is why we recommend that it's not simply a question of the child being assisted to apply for asylum. The other problem, and I think you rightly point this out, is that it's easy for the board to say that the child must be assisted to do that. It's the actual practical reality of putting that in force that one must deal with. Now, the difficulty may be that you may want to deal with those kinds of issues by way of regulations, or by way of the directive-making procedure that's provided for in the bill. The advantage of that is that at least you have an interdisciplinary approach in the bill where there's various stakeholders, the Department of Social Development, Home Affairs and Justice. And importantly in that process, and more so because you do have a mechanism for dealing with the accreditation of institutions, you may want to have a mechanism that provides for, so there are various factors that have to be taken into account in providing that accreditation. But at the end of the day, there should be a mechanism in the bill for making these provisions a reality. And in the absence of that, you would have the legislation simply providing for that right, but its actual enforcement would be difficult. Why we recommend that there should be other mechanisms, not simply the refugees, the assistance through the asylum process. As the committee members would know, that the refugee and asylum system is not there to deal with all classes of people that are foreigners in South Africa. It relates to people that have a fear of persecution in their country of origin and that would qualify for refugee status in terms of that act. And yes, and what we're essentially saying is that there should be provision for a child through to allow for that child's immigration status to be regularized through other mechanisms, either the Citizenship Act or the Immigration Act.
All the members, we stop at this point. We are going to have lunch. How, I don't know. No, there is no lunch prepared. Huh? What I can tell you is that we are coming back